Lecture 2. RHC Indications and Hemodynamic Assessment. Slide 1. Welcome to the second lecture in the right heart catheterisation series by Dr. Eugene Cotlier from St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney. In this lecture, we will deal with the indications for right heart catheterisation, focus specifically on the right heart procedure itself, and again, review some of the measurements that should be taken as part of a standard assessment. We will also touch on some of the potential risks associated with right heart catheterisation, and all operators should be aware of these. Slide 2. On completion of this lecture, you should have a sound understanding of the following. The indications and contraindications for right heart catheterisation, the common access sites for catheterisation, and the advantages, disadvantages of each. Recall the normal and abnormal intracardiac pressures and some limitations of right heart catheterisation measurements. Describe some of the risks associated with right heart catheterisation. Slide 3. Right heart catheterisation is the gold standard for the diagnosis of pulmonary arterial hypertension. However, it also provides clinicians with an indication of the disease severity, including the effects of the pulmonary arterial hypertension on right heart function. Pulmonary vasodilation reserve can also be assessed during a vasodilator challenge, and perhaps most importantly, the measurements obtained on right heart catheterization provide an indication of patient prognosis. Slide 4. The indications for right heart catheterization are listed on this slide and include: to look for evidence of significant left and right ventricular failure, valve disease, myocardial or indeed pericardial disease, and intracardiac shunting, as occurs in congenital heart disease. Right heart catheterization also provides direct measurement of intracardiac pressures, including right atrial pressure, right ventricular pressure, pulmonary artery pressure, and pulmonary artery wedge pressure. Cardiac output can be determined via either the thermodilution or FIC method, and the procedure also gives access to pace the ventricle temporarily, and it can be used to perform electrophysiology studies. Lastly, access during right heart catheterization can be used to perform pulmonary angiography. Slide 5. This slide will be familiar to you from the first lecture. It is a key table from the European guidelines and describes the prognostic features associated with pulmonary arterial hypertension. Hemodynamically, the most important things are to try to maintain a normal right atrial pressure and normal cardiac index. Of course, the right heart catheterization procedure allows us to determine these directly. Slide 6. Contraindications to right heart catheterization include the factors listed here. Mechanical prosthesis of either the tricuspid or the pulmonary valve, thrombi in the right chambers, or suspected endocarditis of the tricuspid or pulmonary valve. Slide 7. Medicare item numbers for the right heart catheter include 38200 for fluoroscopy, saturation runs, thermodilution, cardiac output, shunt studies, and exercise training, either supine bicycle studies or straight leg raises. In addition, you can use an ultrasound to guide the catheterization or delineate the jugular vein, and this is covered by Medicare item number 55054. Slide 8. The equipment involves a monitoring pressure unit, an ECG machine, a pressure transducer, 7 French Swan-Ganz thermodilution catheter, although some centers will use an older Corno catheter, and a cardiac output computer. Slide 9. Standard preparation materials are shown on this slide. Slide 10. The pressure transducers are sterile, pre-packed, and pre-calibrated. They have a high accuracy and sensitivity, that is, the ability to detect small pressure variations. In addition, they have the ability to respond quickly to pressure changes. Slide 11. The standard approaches for catheter access are illustrated here. The most common are the femoral vein and the internal jugular on the right side, but a cubital vein can also be used. At St. Vincent's, the jugular approach is preferred. However, it should be noted that when right heart catheterization studies are performed in a standard catheter laboratory, the femoral vein is usually used. Slide 12. The advantage of the internal jugular approach is that it is close to the right chambers and the Swan-Ganz catheter curls conveniently into the right atria, right ventricle and pulmonary artery. The disadvantages are that the skin access may be difficult due to a short neck or in an overweight individual. However, ultrasound guidance helps to overcome these difficulties. Potential complications include puncture of the carotid artery, and because the apex of the lung is close to the access point, the risk of a pneumothorax exists. Access via the right femoral vein is usually performed when the procedure is done in conjunction with a left heart catheter study, and using this approach, bleeding is often easier to control. Hematoma is also a potential complication with this approach. The cubital vein can be subject to variable anatomy. It can be difficult to steer the catheter and phlebitis can occur as a complication. The left subclavian access is much more difficult and the incidence of pneumothorax is higher. Slide 13. Here is a brief overview of the procedure if performed from either right internal jugular vein with ultrasound guidance or via the femoral vein if done in conjunction with left heart catheterization. The procedure typically takes 15 to 20 minutes, can be performed on outpatients, and no fasting is required. It is also important to note that anticoagulation does not need to be stopped as long as the INR is between 2 and 3. In fact, it is safer not to stop warfarin in patients with pulmonary arterial hypertension. Slide 14. The patient is placed in a supine position without a pillow, on the X-ray table, either in the catheter lab or in the procedure room, with access to an image intensifier. The patient is breathing room air, and if you are using the jugular approach, the head is turned to the left and the neck is slightly extended. You can see here the anatomical landmarks formed by the two heads of sternocleidomastoid and the clavicle. It can become more prominent by lifting the patient's head off the bed or by turning the head to the left against resistance. Jugular pulsation can be seen in patients with tricuspid regurgitation, and that can be helpful when identifying the access point. Slide 15. A great advance, however, has been the ability to localize the jugular vein using a sonocyte ultrasound probe. In the bottom right picture, you can see quite a prominent jugular vein and a small pulsating carotid artery. In a situation like this, it is quite easy to cannulate the jugular vein. However, when the right atrial pressures are not elevated, the jugular vein is much smaller, as viewed in the top right image. Obviously, this would be much more difficult to cannulate without the assistance of ultrasound. Slide 16. To begin the procedure, local anaesthetic is injected approximately 2 finger breadths above the clavicle in the middle of the triangle described above, and a 22-gauge needle is used to locate the internal jugular vein first. The needle is advanced at 40 degrees from the vertical and 20 degrees to the right of the midline, and the jugular vein is usually located 1 to 2.5 centimetres below the skin. If the vein is not located, then one should try the lateral or medial angulation, although the more medial you go, the greater the risk of puncturing the carotid artery, so caution is required. If venous pressure is low, it can be helpful to tilt the head down and elevate the legs in order to increase venous return. Slide 17. Here again are the anatomical landmarks of the internal and external jugular veins and the position of the needle puncture in the image to the right. Slide 18. Once the right internal jugular vein is located, a puncture can be made following the same angle with a larger 18-gauge needle through which the guide wire is advanced into the right atria. At this point, it also helps to check the position of the guide wire with fluoroscopic or echo guidance. A small nick is made in the skin at the entry point with a scalpel blade. The needle is then removed and a 9-French sheath is inserted over the guide wire. This is a classical Seldinger technique. The Swan-Ganz catheter can then be inserted via the sheath and the catheter passage is then guided with fluoroscopy or echo if fluoroscopy is not available. Slide 19. This slide again highlights the Seldinger technique of locating the vein, advancing the guide wire, followed by advancing the sheath. Slide 20. The shape of the Swan-Ganz catheter facilitates the passage from the superior vena cava to the pulmonary artery, particularly from the internal jugular position, and then, using the inflated balloon, floating the catheter from the right atrium through the tricuspid valve into the right ventricle and then into the pulmonary artery. Slide 21. This slide simply demonstrates the catheter route using the two different access points, the internal jugular vein in the image on the left and the femoral vein in the image on the right. You can see in the left panel the natural curve of the Swan-Ganz through the right atria, right ventricle and pulmonary artery. Accessing the right ventricle from the femoral approach can be a little more difficult, and the catheter needs to be twisted back on itself in the right atria before it can be advanced through the tricuspid valve. The other point to note with the femoral approach is that the passage is relatively long, and the catheter can become wedged in the side tributaries of the inferior vena cava. Slide 22. This image shows the catheter in the wedge position using a jugular access approach. Slide 23. Before any measurement is taken, it is important to establish the zero point for the transducer. This is traditionally done by using a level whereby the transducer is placed alongside the left atrium. The reference point, according to surface anatomy, is the mid-axillary line, or the tip of the shoulder. Slide 24. Here is a pressure tracing, and you can see the zeroing that occurs when the transducer dome is open to the atmosphere. Slide 25. The Swan-Ganz catheter is used to measure the right atrial pressure, advanced through the tricuspid valve to measure the right ventricular pressure, and then again advanced through the pulmonary valve to measure the pulmonary artery pressures, systolic, diastolic, and mean. The balloon will then wedge into one of the branches of the pulmonary artery, thus providing a pulmonary arterial wedge pressure. It is important for operators to note that intracardiac pressures should be measured twice, approximately 10 minutes apart or until two consecutive values do not differ by greater than 10%. Similarly, cardiac output should be measured three or more times until three consecutive values do not differ by more than 10%. Slide 26. Here again is the advancing of the Swan-Ganz catheter through the different cardiac chambers and the different waveforms that occur in each. This information was covered in detail during the first lecture, and for individuals who wish to advance and become proficient at right heart catheterization, it is important to study and become familiar with these waveforms. Slide 27. Again, it is important to commit to memory the normal intracardiac pressures in order to appreciate the deviations that occur in situations such as pulmonary arterial hypertension. Slide 28. We will now talk briefly about the pulmonary artery wedge pressure controversy, as this is something that is discussed regularly within the literature and again within the pulmonary hypertension community. It is important to note that the pulmonary artery wedge pressure approximates the left atria pressure, and there are certain situations in which the wedge pressure may overestimate the left atrial pressure. These situations include acute respiratory failure, chronic obstructive lung disease in pulmonary hypertension, pulmonary venoconstriction, or if the catheter size, such as a small balloon tip, is too small for the pulmonary artery. Left atrial pressure can also be greater than left ventricular end diastolic pressure in situations of mitral regurgitation and mitral stenosis, while the opposite can occur in acute aortic regurgitation and in situations with a non-compliant left ventricle. Slide 29. A number of studies have suggested that the wedge pressure tracing is technically inadequate in approximately 30% of cases, and furthermore, approximately 50% of pressure tracings are misinterpreted. This data really highlights the importance of studying the pressure tracings that were covered in the first lecture, understanding the physiological basis for the waveforms, and being able to identify normal versus abnormal recordings. Slide 30. This is an image of a pseudo-wedge pressure, or over-wedging, where the wedge pressure is higher than the pulmonary arterial pressure. In a situation such as this, deflation of the balloon is required, followed by appropriate repositioning. Slide 31. A few tips for obtaining a true pulmonary artery wedge pressure are listed on this slide. As mentioned, partially inflating the balloon and gentle forward advancement of the catheter can be used in order to better seat and seal the catheter against the walls of the pulmonary artery branch. In addition, validating an abnormally elevated measurement can be done by gently withdrawing a blood sample from the distal port of the right heart catheter during balloon inflation and wedge recording to ensure that the saturation of the sample matches systemic arterial left atrial saturation. In practice, however, this is rarely done. Slide 32. When the wedge pressure cannot be easily measured, a direct left atrial assessment can be performed, either by measuring the left ventricular end diastolic pressure with a left heart catheter, providing the catheter can be advanced through the aortic valve, which can be difficult in cases of aortic stenosis. The left atrial pressure then reflects the left ventricular end diastolic pressure in the absence of mitral valve disease. Slide 33. So, what are the risks of the right heart catheter? Generally, we tell our patients that there is a 1 in 200 risk of hematoma due to inadvertent puncture of the carotid artery, although that is reduced with ultrasound guidance. The risk of pneumothorax is approximately 1 in 500. Because we infiltrate the skin above the jugular vein with local anesthetic, temporary hoarseness can occur due to the effect of the anesthetic on the laryngeal nerve. The risks of the right heart catheter are also related to the Swan-Ganz insertion. A serious arrhythmia can occur in about 1 in 1,000 patients, although most are transient and atrial arrhythmias can be overdriven by introducing a pacing wire into the right atria via the sheath. There is also a very small risk of pulmonary infarction, particularly if the balloon is inflated with force rather than floated in. Similarly, a pulmonary artery false aneurysm can occur with that technique, or a pulmonary artery or right ventricle perforation. This is why the balloon is usually inflated in the right atrial position and gently floated through the cardiac chambers. Slide 34. The study presented on this slide indicates the frequency of complications that can occur during right heart catheterization procedures performed by experienced centers in the US and Europe. This was a large study involving over 7,000 cases. Approximately half were performed by respiratory physicians and the other half by cardiologists. Serious adverse effects occurred in only 1.1% of patients and only 4 fatal events were recorded. These included a pulmonary artery rupture, a cardiac arrest 15 minutes post-pulmonary angiography, and there were 2 cases of sudden cardiac death. The first occurred whilst the patient was being prepared for the procedure, and the second occurred the day after right heart catheterization. Other adverse effects included hematoma in 10, pneumothorax in 5, and arrhythmias in 10 patients. Slide 35. What are the limitations of the procedure? Well, measurements are generally obtained only after resting conditions in the supine position and may not be representative of hemodynamic responses whilst the patient is active in the upright posture. Under static circumstances, measurements can vary. Indeed, one study investigated prolonged measurements of pulmonary hemodynamics in a group of 12 patients with pulmonary arterial hypertension and found wide intra-individual spontaneous variability. Nevertheless, right heart catheterization remains the gold standard for diagnosis of PAH and for monitoring the response to treatment. Slide 36. The spontaneous variation, however, can be addressed with some simple techniques. Waiting at least 15 minutes after catheter insertion is advisable. Hemodynamic measurements should then be obtained as close together as possible. The respiratory variation should be taken into consideration and all measurements at end expiration. Moreover, as mentioned before, it is important to ensure a true wedge pressure rather than over-wedging the catheter. Slide 37. In summary, right heart catheterization in patients with suspected pulmonary arterial hypertension is the definitive diagnostic investigation. Provides important prognostic information, provides baseline hemodynamics, and provides important therapeutic information. Importantly, the accuracy of right heart catheter depends on the technical ability of the clinician, and if experienced centers perform the procedure, complications are relatively rare.